walk across the courtyard towards the library.
Good evening and welcome to the October issue of Dog-Eared Reads. This month we are celebrating all things Alaska. With Alaska Day on October 18th, I thought it was a good time for us to pay tribute to some of our Alaskan authors and Alaskan themes. Tonight on Dog-Eared Reads, you will hear an interview with Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in our Beyond the Cover segment, which profiles her new book, The Smell of Other People's Houses, which is also on the Alaska Battle of the Books list this year. In our lively lib chat, Ellie shares information about Battle of the Books and some other activities going on at the public library. Nikki Cheadle will review Black Ducks and Salmon Bellies by Craig Mishler, an ethnography of Old Harbor and Yuzinki. We'll also have some announcements about upcoming events at the public library as well as KPLA events that we hope you'll be involved with. In addition, Bob Ross will review The Impossible Rescue. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy the show.
Temple is the pleasures, the world at its base.
We sponsor this monthly show in hopes of generating enthusiasm about reading and books and the resources of the Kodiak Public Library. Storytimes have resumed at the library. On Wednesdays, there's Lapsit Storytime for children ages 0 to 36 months of age from 10:30 to 11, accompanied by their parents or caregivers. On Thursdays, Discover Storytimes for 4- and 5-year-olds are held from 11 to 11:30. This drop-in program is for children accompanied by their parents or caregivers. It's meant to stimulate language, creativity, and thinking skills. On Fridays, from 10:30 to 11, the Toddler Storytimes are held for 3-year-olds that offer playful ways that parents and caregivers can expose toddlers to everyday concepts and vocabulary through favorite authors and illustrators. There are new library hours in effect. The library is now open Mondays at 12:30 until 9 o'clock p.m., Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, 10 a.m. to 9 o'clock p.m., Fridays, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., and Saturdays and Sundays from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. For more information on any of these story times or activities at the Kodiak Public Library, check out their webpage with its library events calendar at city.kodiak.ak.us/library.
I'm Gretchen Wing. Please come check out our fantastic library, and I hope to see you at one of our programs soon. I have always loved going to the library. When I was old enough to ride my bike to the library, that was a pretty big deal in life. So I've always been passionate about the library, and I'm excited about the new building that we have. It is pretty fantastic when you travel to other cities and you look at the libraries that they have. So good job to the previous KPLA board for having such a grand vision. One of the jobs that I took on was working with the book sales and collecting the books that people donate. We have a bin at the library, and I go through the donated books and fill the bin. So come on out and buy a book at the library and help our library programs.
Thank you, Gretchen. And KPLA is always looking for new volunteers or old volunteers to help us out. Coming up on October 15th, we will be having a book sale at the brewery. If you'd like to help us get the books out or put things away, you can contact us again at kpla.alaska@gmail.com. We also will have a booth at the upcoming AAUW Bazaar November 4th. Stop by, update your membership, and pick up a bookmark or two, or maybe even some kids' books. Hope to see you there. Today, my guest on our Lib Chat on Dog-Eared Reads is with Ellie Werby, children's librarian at the Kodiak Public Library. Welcome, Ellie.
Well, thank you, Laura. Good to be here.
Thank you. It's great to have you here. We're going to talk today about the Battle of the Books. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of Battle of the Books?
Well, I recently found out that the Battle of the Books was originally started as a radio program in Chicago in the 1930s. So a bit of a trivia program. My first introduction to the Battle of the Books was here back in the 1980s when Roz Guzman, a former librarian at the Kodiak District, took on Battle of the Books, and she instituted Battle of the Books in the town schools and the village schools, and it was a really strong program for many years.
Yeah, I remember Roz Goodman. She did have a lot to do with it. What is it that you find about the program that's exciting?
What I like about Battle of the Books is it really introduces children to different books. You know, maybe if they're just a sci-fi reader, you know, and they're going, looking at the Battle of the Books list for that year, they might find that they have to read historical fiction, which is something they don't normally do. So, you know, it really introduces kids to different types of books and authors.
And how do they structure the battle? How is it organized?
It's organized to grade levels. So you'll have kindergarten and then K1 to K2, 3, 4, 5, 6, middle school, and then high school.
How many books are on each list?
Well, it varies. Like with kindergarten, there's only 5. And with 3rd and 4th grade, there is about 10 books. So there's quite a few books to read for a class.
And how many children are on each team usually?
On each team, there are 4. So what will happen is when the school decides to participate in Battle of the Books, 3rd and 4th grade, many kids will sign up to be on the battle, but it'll come down to 4 on the team, 3 in an alternate.
Okay. Do they have to read all the books on the list? Say there's 10 or 12 books on the 4th grade list. Do they have to read every one?
They should read every one so that they know the answers that are presented during the battle.
Ah, how do the battles themselves work? How are they run?
Each school will have a battle. Maybe there are 2 3rd grade classes, so they'll battle within those classes and see which classes will represent the school.
Mm-hmm.
And then in February, they will battle district-wide. Uh-huh. So Peterson, North Star, Maine, all the village schools will come together in February and have a battle.
Does everybody come into town and battle, or how do they do that?
Well, last year we had some participants from village schools over a web-based program, and then there, I think it was Akiak that came in for the battle.
Oh, how exciting for them. Can anybody join who wants to, who's in those grade levels?
Anyone can join, but being part of the team, I think, is chosen by the teacher who is volunteer for the battle for the school.
How often do you have kids come in the library and ask you about Battle of the Books?
Almost every day.
Do you?
Several times a day. It's a great list for students to choose from and also for parents who are not quite sure what to read at that grade level. So it's a good list of books to choose from.
Well, I wonder, does it appeal to our homeschool crowd?
It does. And this year, they will be having a battle team.
Oh, they're going to have their own team.
Yep. AK Teach has a battle team. The district has a battle team. And also St. Mary's participates in Battle of the Books.
That's right. Do you have to do much to encourage their involvement? Or do they just, everybody wants to be involved in the elementary schools?
I believe everybody wants to be involved. It's a fun program for kids.
And do you work with Kodiak School District in this effort?
We do. We host the battle here in a multipurpose room in February.
In the library?
In the library.
Mm-hmm.
We always buy multiple copies of each set of books for each grade level,
mm-hmm.
and also buy extra electronic copies of books.
Oh, so they could download it through
Alaska Digital Library.
Okay.
Yeah, Alaska Digital Library will have their own copy of each one of the books, but Kodiak Public Library buys an additional copy so that it's available.
Well, that's good to know. A lot of people probably don't know that they can get them electronically if they have that app on their device. Are you doing anything special this year? Do you have any special promotions that you're thinking of doing or in the works?
Well, a few years ago, we did a buddy battle during the Christmas holidays, which brought all mm-hmm. the 3rd, 4th grade students together who were participating in the battle and any of the kids who read battle books. And we just mixed all the kids up and just had a buddy battle.
Mm-hmm.
And it was good practice for them to just know how the battle is run and for answering questions and for challenging questions.
Well, speaking of the questions, how are the questions structured?
So the questions are structured, and it'll start off with, in which book did the character do this or that? And you have to answer the correct book, and you get 2 points for naming the correct book and another point for naming the correct author of the book.
So they have to know those titles and authors
pretty
well.
They have to know titles and authors.
And the team works together before they give the answer?
Correct. They'll work together. They have so many, you know, they'll have a minute to figure out the answer, write it down on the paper, and then they have to respond to the answer.
You said that the battles were held in February. How long does it usually take when you, like, say, for 1 grade level?
Usually about an hour and a half.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then when do the state battles happen?
And then the state battles will happen. The high school battle happens, I believe, February 26th. Middle school will be the 27th. The 28th will be the 5th and 6th, and March 1st will be 3rd and 4th. Most of the kindergarten and K-1 battles do not go to the state. They usually do that as a reading incentive program in the school.
In the school, I see. What's the biggest challenge for students who want to get involved? Is it not knowing anybody or not knowing how to get involved? Or do you find students who don't have a clue?
I think there are a lot of students that don't have a clue, you know, and maybe they'll see the list and wonder what it's about. And it's really up to the classroom teacher whether they're promoting that Battle of the Books within the school. And there's usually one volunteer teacher that takes on the program for that school. So a lot of kids will say, I want to read it, but don't have the time to finish the whole list.
Mm-hmm. And that could be daunting for
it could be daunting, yeah. And then also those teams will get together and practice, so that's always practice time too.
There's always that too. Well, is there anything else you'd like to tell us about Battle of the Books this year?
There's some great books on Battle of the Books. I've read, you know, quite a few, and I think it'll be a good battle this year.
Oh, great. Well, we're excited that it's going to happen. We're also excited that in this issue of Dog-Eared Reads, we have an interview by Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. So
yes, author on one of the battle books for the high school.
Yes.
That's exciting.
It is exciting. Well, Ellie, thank you so much for your time today. It's a pleasure talking to you. And if anybody's interested in Battle of the Books, please talk to Ellie at the public library, 486-8683.
Thank you,
Ellie. Bye-bye.
If you just joined us, you're listening to Dog-Eared Reads on KODK 90.7, Kodiak, Alaska.
Today on Beyond the Cover, our author interview section of Dog-Eared Reads, I speak to Bonnie Sue Hitchcock to learn about her writing passions, her work, and a little bit about her life. Bonnie Sue Hitchcock was born and raised in Alaska. She worked many years fishing commercially with her family and as a reporter for Alaska public radio stations. She was the host and producer of Independent Native News, a daily newscast focusing on Alaska Natives, American Indians, and Canada's First Nations. Her first book, The Smell of Other People's Houses, was published in 2016. Welcome, Bonnie Sue.
Hi, Lori. Thank you so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. You have written The Smell of Other People's Houses, a story about several young people's lives in Fairbanks and Southeast Alaska during the 1970s. Threaded throughout the book are metaphors relating to the relevance of the smells of places. Where did this idea come from, and why do you believe it's important?
Well, the idea actually literally came in a writing exercise that I did with a friend, and we used to get together and just throw out prompts and ideas to write about. And she said, let's write for 20 minutes about the smell of other people's houses, just this kind of idea, right? This quirky idea. Mm-hmm. And so we did. And it, you know, that was, I think I maybe wrote 800 words or something. And then slowly from that, you know, it morphed and I rewrote it to make it a short story. And then I kind of the book started to take shape after that. And the metaphor of smells, it was supposed to do a number of different things. Hopefully it did them, but mm-hmm. Originally this was going to be a book of connected short stories, not just one long narrative. And so that was my idea. And so the original book was, you know, 20 different characters, 20 different stories that were all just barely linked together. And the idea was that you would just, it's the same, it was supposed to have the same feeling that you have when you walk into someone's house and you mm-hmm. open the door for the first time and you get this smell. And I think that smell is one of our, I'm sure there's been some science done on this, but it's one of our strongest senses, and it evokes all of these things like memory or just, it's really, really powerful. And I think sometimes when we walk into someone's house, we don't even realize how quickly we're being informed about things. Whether they're correct or not, we get an impression from that smell. And so that's what the stories were supposed to do as short stories, just give you an impression of this, of people, and then kind of move on to the next one. So that's why I wanted to call the whole book The Smell of Other People's Houses. And then through the editorial process and everything, it changed to be the book it is now. But I still think that when you make a judgment or a snap judgment about something as simple as like what something smells like, it comes from your own personal experience of that smell, perhaps. Uh-huh. And then you sort of think you know something about those people, and you could be right or you could be wrong. So anyway, that was, all of those things were in my mind as I was writing.
It's very powerful, and it's brought up several times throughout the book and interweaves it very well. I really enjoyed that. And since then, I've tried to notice more and more when I go in places, that smells like our local True Value hardware store, for example, or that smells like Joe's house or something. So you've hit it on the head, I think. This book is told from four characters' viewpoints and their interconnectedness with their families and their friends. It's an interesting format to tell the stories, and I was wondering, why did you use this literary technique, and how did it help or hinder you in the writing process? Did telling the story like this make it easier or harder to write?
Well, that is a great question to bounce off the last one, because it's sort of related, right? So originally I had those 20 characters, and then, you know, I worked with two different editors throughout this process. So one was in New York and one was in London. It was this really interesting experience, especially because I had been an editor for Radio Stories, as you know. So it was fun to sort of be on the other end as well. And I could kind of get inside their heads. And when the book changed from being a collection of short stories to a long narrative, obviously 20 main characters is too many. And so they said, you know, we'll let you do six. You can choose six of these characters. I realized as I tried to do that, it was really difficult. So I chose the four that had, I thought, the strongest voices. All of the secondary characters in the book used to have like their own chapter. So every character that is in the book, almost every character had their own chapter. And, you know, I think it was really similar to actually putting a radio story together. And I did love doing it this way because I think that you learn more about people when you're in another character's head. And I think it's more three-dimensional. It's more like real life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would never do a radio story that had just one source. You know, you always want to get as many sources as you can to inform the subject. And that's what I was doing with this story. But because it's so funny, like a lot of these decisions are not as intentional as they might seem. You know, you have your original story, and then over 18 months of rewriting a book, different, you know, things get dropped and things get added. And so it's really hard sometimes to go back and remember exactly the intent of why that particular thing is there. Mm-hmm. But that is why there's four main characters and why the story is told that way. I hope that answered your question.
Oh, that's interesting. Very interesting. Did you set out to write a young adult novel, or do you feel it's going to be read by many age groups?
I absolutely did set out to write a young adult novel. It is something that I have wanted to do forever. And 20 years ago, maybe longer, maybe 25 years ago, I was a member of the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, and I wrote picture books, and I really loved that genre of books and writing. And it just seemed kind of impossible. And then I sort of had this other life with raising kids and commercial fishing and public radio. And so it was something I came back to later as mm-hmm. this thing that just wouldn't die in my head. So it was always intended to be a young adult. And then I actually went back and got an MFA in writing for children and young adults just to sort of give me some confidence. I didn't really have the confidence to think that it was a possibility. And that was really helpful. So I'm glad I did that.
Well, it's on the Battle of the Books list this year for high school. And it's also being read by book groups, at least here in Kodiak. We've had a couple of book groups, adults, read it in their book groups and receiving some.
Wow, thanks, Kodiak.
You're welcome. In the beginning of the book, the prologue is written from Ruth's viewpoint. Why did you decide to introduce the story from her point of view rather than one of the other characters?
That is a good question about, you know, kind of segues from my, like, some of these things weren't so intentional. You know, those chapters all got flipped around a bazillion times in the editing process. And I think in the end, why it came out the way it did, partially because a really important theme of the book is statehood, when Alaska became a state in 1959, of course. And so I needed to set that up, and Ruth's character really did that. Like, she sort of perceives everything terrible in her life happening, like, is connected with Alaska becoming a state.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, that the prologue is right around the time of statehood, and then the book jumps to 1970s. That's pretty much, it was a structural thing more mm-hmm. than anything else.
And that was informative to us, that statehood wasn't something that everybody wanted, that there was some argument about it, or that the Native people felt it wouldn't be good for them. Of course, this story takes place before the pipeline, before Anilka, and starts before statehood. But it's a point of view some people don't know about.
Right. And I know it wasn't the majority point of view. I mean, Alaska, it was voted in pretty significantly. But there are pockets of people that were opposed to statehood.
I bet there were.
So I chose to focus on that.
Tell us about your life in Alaska. Where did you grow up? Where did you fish? How much time are you able to spend at home these days?
That's a funny one, Lori. Yeah, so I was born in Fairbanks. My mom was born in Fairbanks, and my grandma was born right across the border. She came over when she was about 10, so it was pretty much been that. My grandma's 97. She's still living in her own home in Fairbanks. But when I was about 5, my dad took a job in Anchorage, and he was a manager for Westmark Hotels. And so we moved to Anchorage, and that's where I went to school, grew up. But we spent all our summers in Fairbanks, so I still think of Fairbanks as really, like, my home. And then I went to Sheldon Jackson College in Sitka and ended up staying there and commercial fishing there. And got started in public radio in Sitka at Raven Radio.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Well, some of the stories that you tell are definitely stories of home, I think. In the book, the character of Dumpling is very interesting to me because she's not one of the four narrators of the story, but she's very important to the story. And she seems to drive the three of the four narratives that are told. She's a sympathetic listener. She's a person that's well-liked. She saved those red strips from a slip caught in a fence during a flood in Fairbanks, and she has a whole cigar box full of them. I figure it's good luck, she said. Quote, you know, a reminder of what love can do. Sometimes you just have to hold on to whatever you can. Does Dumpling represent something metaphorical or someone you may have known or loved in your family?
She actually is pretty metaphorical, and I'm really impressed that you got all of that out of her character, because my original writing of the book, Dumpling, was even more significant in those 20 short stories. She again, didn't have her own story, but you knew her through everyone else's story, which is similar to what happened in the end. But in the original book, she was that link between everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And she is the most important character in my mind because of that, because of how she informs everyone else and how she kind of is that connector. She's a connector person. And I'm hoping that maybe someday I can revisit my, you know, everything changed in the book as far as, you know, the plot and different things, which is great. I mean, I'm happy with everything about what happened with the book, but there is an untold story that I would like to go back to at some point. I can't reveal too much in case I get to go back to it. I mean, I don't know if it will ever happen, but it is a significant sort of Dumpling story.
Yes, she's an interesting character. We asked in our book group what character was everyone's favorite, and she was about everybody's favorite character. They thought she...
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Thought that she really did bring that connectedness to everybody involved in the story. What was the writing process like? You said you wrote 20 different characters, different points of view. Did you commit yourself to writing every single day? Was it written over a long period of time? What was the writing process like?
Well, originally, like I said, I went back to do an MFA in writing for children and young adults. And the original draft was my thesis for graduating from that program. And so that was written pretty quickly. It was about 6 months. It was one semester, the last semester of my MFA. And then after I sold it to the publishers, the rewrite took 18 months, the actual, you know, reworking of it. And at the same time, you know, we had tried to live in the lower 48 for the first time in our lives. Mm-hmm. And our house got flooded in the 2013 floods in Colorado. And that was 2 weeks after I had sold the manuscript. So I didn't really have a home for 18 months to write in. And, you know, just other things, you know, life actually still goes on, whether or not you're trying to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun. So I wrote a lot of the, I ended up, you know, just writing when I could and where I could. But for me, deadlines are so important. You know, I've written all my life, and I think if I had never had a deadline, nothing would have ever been finished.
So do you have that advice? What advice do you have for aspiring authors, people who want to write? To have deadlines?
Nobody ever wants my advice, Lori.
Oh!
But, yeah, I guess I would just say never give up. You know, I was almost 50 when this book came out, and I have been writing all my life. As you know, it's just something I do that I love to do, and I think if publishing is the way you equate being a writer, it might be a little more difficult, but I would just say never ever give up on what you want for yourself.
What authors or books have provided great inspiration to you?
I love the classics. I love Virginia Woolf and I love Tolstoy. I read Anna Karenina every year at Christmas.
Ooh.
I reread it. And then I love contemporary books too. I read a lot. I read lately a lot more adult fiction because it's harder to read YA when you're writing YA. I just think for me.
Uh-huh.
And so I love Ann Patchett. I love Lauren Groff and Miley Malloy, who also writes middle grade. She's kind of this amazing. She can write everything, short stories, middle grade, adult fiction.
Uh-huh.
And then I read poetry every single day when I wake up just to hear language, hear beautiful words strung
yes.
together like Christmas lights. Yeah.
Oh, neat. That's a nice metaphor. On your Twitter feed, you describe yourself as a public radio reporter moonlighting as a YA writer. Do you feel yourself more of a reporter, or do you feel you've morphed into a novelist now?
Well, it's funny. When I put that on Twitter, I probably hadn't even had, the book wasn't even published yet. So I definitely wasn't seeing myself as a novelist. And I still don't really, I still feel a little bit amazed that you know, I have written a book and that it is in the world and people actually are reading it. I do see myself still as a public radio reporter. I'm still working on some projects on the side. I have a grant from the Fund for Investigative Journalism, and I've been working on a story up in Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the writing and being a novelist, being a writer, is just such a dream that I don't think it's quite real. I was a reporter for over 15 years, and I think, you know, that's so embedded in me. And I still feel like radio has informed how I write as well. I mean, I feel like I write, you know, short sentences and that have a lot of, like, you know, carry a big punch. And all of that is from my training as a public radio person. And
mm-hmm.
I'm really grateful for that. I think it's really, really helped me in my life.
Well, it's also important in YA novels because short sentences that carry a punch are important in the structure of the book.
I think that's great. That's a good way to put it. And you know, I also feel like every word should matter. And
mm-hmm.
I used to be so jealous of those print reporters that we'd cover the same event. They're like, I have, like, you know, this huge column. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, I have 4 minutes to do that same thing, you know.
Right. It's a different way.
Yeah, right.
The Smell of Other People's Houses has been translated into several languages, and you've spent the last year traveling to some of the countries where it's been published. And it, as I mentioned, it's on the High School Battle of the Books this year, and the reviews have been very positive. John Corey Whaley, author of Where Things Come Back, said, quote, Hitchcock's debut resonates with the timeless quality of a classic. This is a fascinating character study, a poetic interweaving of rural isolation and coming of age, end quote. Are you surprised at the reviews and the immense success you have received?
Totally flabbergasted, actually. Yes, I'm completely surprised. And can I just say that Where Things Come Back by John Corey Whaley was one of my favorite books. And when he, you know, blurbed it, it's called a blurb. It's a funny word, right?
Right.
Yeah, when he blurbed my book, it was, like, unbelievable to me.
Mm-hmm.
I just totally adore his writing. And, yeah,
absolutely.
I am completely surprised. I really am. And I am really honored, and I don't take it for granted at all. I think this is an unusual turn of events.
Well, you're heading off to New Zealand tomorrow, I think?
I'm actually heading to Germany for 2 weeks. The book was nominated for the German Literature Prize at the Frankfurt Book Fair. So
Ooh.
I'm heading over there for that.
That's a big deal.
It's an incredible honor.
Oh, yeah. Congratulations.
Thanks, Lori.
Do you have another book in progress?
I do. I'm writing something now. And the only thing that I actually can say about it is that it has nothing to do with Alaska.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sure it'll be great. If you just joined us, I'm on Beyond the Cover. I'm speaking with Bonnie Sue Hitchcock, author of The Smell of Other People's Houses. And it's been a real pleasure to speak with you today. Is there anything else you'd like to add or tell us about yourself or your writing experiences?
No, I just want to thank you. And I told you before, you know, how much I love public radio. I love KMXT. I've actually produced stories for Alaska Fisheries Report in the past, and so I love that station, and I'm very, very honored to be on your show.
Well, it's an honor for us to be able to speak with you. Thank you, Bonnie Sue Hitchcock, for joining us, and it was a pleasure, as I said. Safe travels to you.
Thank you so much.
No, you're welcome.
Temple is the pleasures, the world at its base.
The story From Rumpelstiltskin to War and Peace is one of the basic tools invented by the human mind for the purpose of gaining understanding. There have been great societies that did not use the wheel, but there have been no societies that did not tell stories. Ursula K. Le Guin.
I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm, bookworm. I'm a B-O-O-K worm. I like to read and I like to write, and I wear glasses to improve my sight. Chemistry, math, and reading too. They're all fun subjects for me and you. I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm, bookworm. I'm a B-O-O-K worm. Don't be afraid to be a bookworm. Don't be scared to read and learn.
What?
Being smart is not a crime. Take a minute to listen to this rhyme.
I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm, bookworm. I'm a B-O-O-K worm.
Everybody, don't be afraid to be a bookworm. Raise your hand if you're a bookworm. Raise it high in the air. I'm a B-O-O-K worm.
I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm, bookworm. I'm a B-O-O-K worm. I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm, bookworm. I'm a B-O-O-K worm.
Today on our show, Bob Ross is joining me, and he's got a book that he found in the young adult section of the library that details an amazing part of Alaska's history. So let's hear from Bob Ross and his latest book review on the Community Roar segment.
Hello and welcome to another in the series of book reviews from the archives of the Kodiak Public Library, Alaska Room. Deviating just a bit, in this month's book review, it comes not actually from the Alaska Room, but it will soon be there. But it comes from the juvenile section of the library. The book's name, The Impossible Rescue, the true story of an amazing Arctic adventure by Martin W. Sandler. This 2012 softbound, easily read, and exceptionally well illustrated 163-page book is published by Candlewick Press. It is the successful rescue story of the Arctic whaling fleet trapped near Point Barrow in September of 1897. Now, they had felt that they had another 5 weeks of whaling time when cold weather came in and locked them in place. There were 8 boats that were trapped, 9 actually. The Alexander spent 18 hours both ramming forward and back and breaking a channel out to open water to escape the ice pack. It involved about 300 people trapped in the vicinity of Point Barrow. This is perhaps the greatest account that I have read of heroism, sacrifice, and endurance, both over land and sea, and it involves the revenue cutter, the Bear, and primarily 3 of its officers that formed what was later to be known as the Overland Relief Expedition. When the Alexander got back to its home port in San Francisco, they spread the word that the whaling fleet was trapped. Telegraph from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. alerted the president and his staff that there was potential for a mass starvation of the whaling fleet. They had provisions that would last them for a few months, but nowhere near what it would take to reach the spring thaw the following year. President William McKinley ordered the Bear to their rescue and relief. Captain Tuttle, in command of the Bear, was given full, carte blanche to loading the Bear with supplies and to head off in relief, but he was to travel as far north as he could before hitting the ice pack and then letting 3 of his officers off to make their way by foot to the relief of the people at Point Barrow. Captain Tuttle realized that he might not be able to get any closer than 1,500 miles, and we're talking about the dead of winter. The orders came down in mid-November of 1897. The orders as well stated that the overland route was to be taken by the three officers, and they were to link up with two different reindeer herders that were on the Seward Peninsula. There they were to convince these reindeer herders that they should relinquish their reindeer herd and accompany the revenue officers to Point Barrow so that the reindeer would then provide the food for the whalers. This, to me, is rather a interesting concept because there was no guarantee that the herders would agree with this plan. And so it all hinged upon the ability of the revenue cutters to convince these herders to do this task. And I think that's why we were calling this the impossible task. But even once they linked up, they still had 1,200 to 1,500 miles yet to travel to Point Barrow at temperatures which ranged as low as 60 below zero.
Right. So this is a pretty difficult, well, impossible journey. Not only are they sailing the boat, as far north as they can and then stopping and from there heading overland to help, they have to somehow convince two different individuals to help them with this project by relinquishing their entire herd, helping to herd them over, and then providing food. We talked about this a minute ago, Bob, and you mentioned that this whaling fleet of about 300 whalers was in serious peril, but it wasn't just the whalers now that were in peril because they were in the Point Barrow area. And what was the approximate population of Point Barrow at the time?
Well, at that time, actually, it was the Point Barrow station was a little over 100 people, mostly natives and a few whites that had a trading post, and there was one naturalist that was there collecting samples. Some of the buildings that were there were hardly usable. They had to cannibalize some of their buildings to make room for a portion of the whalers that would be needed to be housed there because some of the ships were crushed in the ice. Some of these ships were as far away as 65 miles from Point Barrow. It was too much for the community and for the fleet. It was just too much of a burden. And actually, the fleet was in danger of starvation, as was the people at the Barrow station.
Right. Once they tried to help, it tripled the size of the town they had. So all of a sudden, their resources were scarce. And now the people living in Barrow were also at danger. So this is a very important mission, not just to save the whalers, but the people of Port Barrow as well. So in this book, it focuses on some of these main players.
Do you have a favorite, Bob, from when you read it?
I think each of the three officers and the two herders are probably the prime players in this particular book. But rather than detail how they went about solving this mission and the energies and the routes that they had to take to obtain it, just know that this was successful. Know as well that it should be common knowledge, yet for me, it was not, and possibly for you, it was not either. And one of the reasons for this is that upon the completion of their mission, it was buried in the newspapers because the Spanish-American War had just broken out, and everything at that point was directed to the new war effort. The thing I liked as well about this book, besides the fascinating read and the tremendous photographs that were taken by Dr. McCall, who was the physician and also the cook for this expedition, was that at the end of the book, it gives you kind of a Paul Harvey, and now for the rest of the story, it takes your cast of characters and it gives you a breakout of what these people did for the balance of their careers. It also takes the revenue cutter Bear and gives you its history. The revenue cutter Bear is, of course, important to the Kodiak area as well, especially around 1913 when we were covered in ash. Ellsworth Bertholdt was one of the three officers that were put ashore. He later became the first commandant of the Coast Guard and was the prime fighter among the other services to keep the Coast Guard as a separate entity from the Navy or the Marine Corps, where political factions wish to put it. I found this book to be, perhaps, if I were to read only one book on Alaska this year, this would be the book. And to find it in the juvenile section is an amazing thing, because the book does say it's for ages 10 and up, but I didn't get it when I was in school, and I should have, and so should you have. This is just fascinating Alaska history.
And just because of a quirk of fate, it got buried historically behind the war. That's fascinating. So tell us a little bit about the future of one of these characters.
Let's talk about the bear itself, because I find the bear to be just a fascinating study. In this chapter of the book, and this starts on page 135 of the book, what happened to them? And it has the bear. From the time that it brought the rescue whaled men back to Seattle until well into the 1900s, the bear continued to patrol Alaska waters, providing aid to mariners and to people living along the coast. When it was put into dry dock in the late 1920s, it appeared that the ship's days at sea were finally over. But destiny still had many new adventures in store for the bear. Purchased by famed explorer Admiral Richard Byrd, the bear carried the Byrd and his party to two historic trips to Antarctic, first in 1933, 34, and then in 1939 to 41. When the United States entered World War II in 1941, the bear was again passed into service patrolling the waters off Greenland and Iceland. Soon after the war ended in 1945, the ship was dry docked once again, this time in Halifax, Nova Scotia. But in 1963, she was purchased by a businessman from Philadelphia who intended to turn her into a floating restaurant. Almost as if in protest of such a degrading ending to such a proud and historic past, the bear's old seams opened up while she was being towed to Philadelphia, and the 89-year-old vessel sunk in 300 feet of water. Despite lengthy underwater search, headed by the man who had discovered the remains of the famous Civil War ironclad, the Monitor, the bear was never found. She still lies in that watery grave. Former Dean of the Coast Guard Academy, David Sandler, has stated, perhaps a fitting place for one so grand a seagoing history.
That is fascinating. So again, for people looking for this book, right now you're going to find it at the Kodiak Public Library in the young adult section. But very soon, hopefully we will have another copy available for you in the Alaskana room. And again, if you're interested, the title of this book is The Impossible Rescue, The True Story of an Amazing Arctic Adventure by Martin W. Sandler. Thanks, Bob, for coming in.
Thank you.
If you have a book review you'd like to give us, or if you want to help out with this show or with the Kodiak Public Library Association in any way, we want to hear from you. You can email us at kpla.alaska@gmail.com or visit us at www.kodiakpubliclibrary.org.
I can tell this isn't Durrani's day, but folks, I've had my moments. Yes, I've had my moments. When I look back through life, I find lots of memories remain. Certain days stay in my mind and keep running through my brain. I remember the day that Edley swam the channel. What a flash! I remember the Wall Street crash, or when Winchell first shouted, flash! But there's one day that I recall, though it was years ago. All my life I will remember it, I know. I'll never forget the day I read a book. It was contagious, 70 pages. There were pictures here and there, so it wasn't hard to bear. The day I read a book. It's a shame I don't recall the name of the book. It wasn't a history, I know, because it had no plot. It wasn't a mystery, because nobody there got shot. The day I read a book, I can't remember when, but one of these days I'm gonna do it again. Why, if you walk into my house, you'll see loads of books. And believe me, they're not there just for appearances. I press an awful lot of butterflies. I know reading is relaxing. What did Napoleon do for relaxation? He read a book. What did Lincoln do for relaxation? He read a book. What does Congress do for relaxation? They book a read. You know, I'm familiar with all the bestsellers. There's the Encyclopedia Britannia, Forever Umbriago, and a new piece of significant literature which says, Atka Gretka Batka, Setka Engelafa, Ala Mali Shui. How do you like that? I've been reading the life story of Mumbles. But I love good reading. Why, last week I spent 2 solid days in the library. Much to my regret, I buried my nose in a book, and what happened? I forgot which book I buried it in. A catastrophe. It wasn't a history. I know because it had no plot. It wasn't a mystery. Because nobody there got shot. One day I read a book. I can't remember when. But one of these days I'm going to do it again. Yes, sir. One of these days I'm going to do it again.
And you're listening to Dog-Eared Reads on KODK 90.7, Kodiak, Alaska. Want to know more about what's happening at the Kodiak Public Library? Stop by the library to pick up the schedule brochure, visit the public library website, follow the Kodiak Public Library Association on Facebook, or visit KPLA's website at kodiakpubliclibraryassociation.org. Events and activities for people of all ages are scheduled throughout the year. Thanks for your support, and happy reading.
Thanks, Dayton.
Hi, my name is Peg. Welcome to Lively Live Chat. I'm here today to talk to you not about an event that's going on at the library, but rather a tool that we have in the library that is designed to help people find what they're looking for. So most people already know that you can search the library catalog either online on the library's website, or you can search it on the iPads throughout the library. And there's also a laptop that's set up specifically for searching the library collection. And that's located just right past the front desk. What I want to highlight is the power search function. Basically, the power search is a way to give users a little bit more control in how they search. I know a lot of us, you know, we do a Google search and we just use a quick little keyword and our search results are pages upon pages of results, not always exactly what we're looking for. So what the power search does is it gives you, as I said, more control over what kind of results you'll see. Now, you'll see when you go to the catalog that there's a link that says Power Search right underneath the search bar for words and phrases. And when you click on that, you'll see that it gives you a lot more variety as far as how to search. Not only can you search by a word or a phrase, but you can also search by author, by specific title, by subject, and even by type, like if you're looking for certain CDs or DVDs. So let's say you just finished reading the latest James Patterson novel and you want to know what else the library has that's by that author. That's the perfect opportunity to use Power Search. You go into author name, you put in James Patterson, and it'll show you all of the books that the library has in their collection by that author. Now, let's say you're only interested in the new releases. You don't want to know about his old books. You can still do a Power Search with that author's name and put in the publication year of 2015. And it will show you everything we have by him that's a new book, new releases. The same thing goes with CDs and DVDs. Let's say you wanted to know whether we carry any Frank Sinatra CDs. Power Search. You put in Frank Sinatra, you put the format as CD, and it will show you everything we have by him. It gives you so much more control over how you search. It's a little bit faster and more efficient, and all the staff at the library are available to help anyone use the Power Search who's interested.
Thanks, Peg. And here's a little tip on how to use Listen Alaska. Do you like to read? Do you like to listen to books? I do. I would like to tell you about Listen Alaska, a free service offered by the Alaska Digital Library, in part from the Kodiak Public Library. It's accessible from a computer, tablet, or a phone. You can listen directly from the browser on your computer or use an OverDrive app on a smartphone or a tablet. They have featured collections that include fiction of various genres for all ages, a wealth of nonfiction titles, and all the battle of the books. You can borrow up to 10 items at a time, and you can put anything on hold that'll be ready for you once it's checked back in. The lending period may vary from title to title, but the maximum is 21 days, and they can be renewed. A really cool feature of this service is when the audiobook or ebook is due, it disappears from your device. No more overdue fines or worrying about getting that item back to the library on time. To get started, you will need to have an active library card to borrow titles. Please visit the Kodiak Public Library and get your PIN, personal identification number, that will allow you to sign on to the Alaska Digital Library and start using it. What? Don't have a library card? Any permanent resident of the Kodiak Island Borough is eligible for a library card. New patrons are asked to show two pieces of identification that have their current mailing address in Kodiak on it, and parental permission is required for children under the age of 15. But once you have your PIN and your library card, you can log into OverDrive on your computer. The URL is listenalaska.lib.overdrive.com, or do a simple search for Listen Alaska and you will find the URL. You can also download the app from iTunes or an Android source, and it's a great way to read more and keep learning. I like to listen to a story while I'm driving and then continue reading it later at a more convenient time. Or with more difficult text, I listen as I follow along in a book. Quite often, our public library has the print version, and then I borrow the audio version from the digital library. It's all free, and it's available 24/7 from Listen Alaska. Check it out. Here's another in our community roars, a book review by Nikki Cheetah on Black Ducks and Salmon Bellies by Craig Mishler.
Hi there, this is Nikki Cheetah. I'm going to read for you a book review I wrote for an English class I'm taking. It's on a book called Black Ducks and Salmon Bellies by Craig Mishler. It's an ethnography of Old Harbor and Yuzinki, Alaska, published in 2001. Craig Mishler's Black Ducks and Salmon Bellies, an ethnography of Old Harbor and Yuzinki, Alaska, is a thorough historical analysis of the captivating Aleutic culture and way of life in the Kodiak Archipelago. The villages of Old Harbor and Yuzinki have unique yet similar histories spanning from pre-Russian influence to present day. They have both suffered from the tragedies of oil spill and tsunami in varying degrees of devastation. They have also shared in similar cultures and both display the level of grit it takes to survive and thrive in such remote locations. Mishler first visited these areas while conducting field research in the aftermath of the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. His interest in the area and his friendships with the Aleutic people grew with time and subsequent visits. Mishler learned that no comprehensive history had yet been documented in regards to these villages and the Aleutic people who lived there. With a background in anthropology, Mishler sets out to remedy this. Mishler claims that history provides clarity and context to the world and culture as we know it today. He addresses topics such as the demography and ethnic identity of the Aleutic people. Mishler illustrates it in this way. Ethnicity in Yuzinki and Old Harbor resembles the structure of sedimentary rock. There are several genetic layers of it, deposited one on top of the other over a 200-year period, with some percolation and melting in between the layers. He then attempts to piece together the bits of information documented by various early explorers and illustrates how excruciatingly difficult life was for the natives in that era. Living conditions, food sources, and many other aspects of life in this 200-year time frame are described in some great detail. Quite an effort is made to cover the early Russian influence on the Aleutic people while shedding light on the root of many religious and cultural traditions. As far as the more recent history goes, Black Ducks is a very personal account of the ebb and flow of life in these two villages. There is an abundance of information and incredible firsthand stories of the ups and downs of the local fishing industry. In addition, much effort is spent elaborating and covering the expressive culture and traditions of the Aleutic people. These are the cultural practices that bind them together in celebration and in savoring the good things in life. this is evidently an aspect of life near and dear to the hearts of the village locals. Another subject that interviewees readily shared about is subsistence. You can hear the pride in their words as they tell hunting stories, share traditional recipes, and describe the fishing lifestyle of their culture. Take this quote from Walt Erickson Sr., for example. "My favorite is ptarmigan, because that's what I was raised on, and my belief is that ptarmigan is a good medicine." And another from Freddie Christensen. "I think that's what holds rural Alaska together, is subsistence. You know, the economy of the world can fail, and by golly, we'll still live, we'll still eat, and you know, that's very important to us." Mishler himself shares a lively story of a sea lion hunt in Old Harbor and gives this insight. "Subsistence means having the freedom to go out and put fresh food on the table every day, year round. It is a traditional and sacred way of living, a way of thinking about the world, a way of seeing the world, and a way of being in the world." Being the first ethnography I have ever had the pleasure of reading, Black Ducks and Salmon Bellies altogether exceeded my expectations. How readily Mishler gives voice to the Aleutic people in his writings is quite admirable. The text is engaging and gives the real people who really live in these villages a chance to tell their stories and take an active part in preserving their own history. Mishler combines his firsthand experiences, various references to scientific articles and historical documents to support his opinions and provide credibility. There were times that Mishler took liberty to connect dots and make assumptions where solid facts were lacking. I would argue that this was done in a discreet, satisfactory, and scholarly way. There was some awkwardness in regards to the dual focus of this ethnography. Bouncing back and forth between the villages of Old Harbor and Yuzinki was at times hard to follow and keep straight. In an educational capacity, this ethnography is exceptional. The many stark photographs, illustrations, maps, and graphs were not only relevant but incredibly helpful in understanding and conceptualizing the information that is being presented. The length of the book is reasonable, and the context and text are laid out in an easy-to-understand and accessible way. Whether you're just moving to town or you've lived here for decades, you are sure to enjoy learning more about this Kodiak Island history. Pick up Black Ducks and Salmon Bellies and give it a read. It is sure to cultivate a deeper understanding of local history and increase your appreciation for this place we call home. This is Nikki. Thank you for listening. This has been Black Ducks and Salmon Bellies, an ethnography of Yuzinki and Old Harbor, Alaska, by Craig Mishler. Happy reading.
Thank you, Nikki, for sharing that review. It was quite interesting. If you would like to share some information about books you've read or to encourage other people to read, please contact KPLA. We are happy to put you on the air, and we will produce your review for you and help you with the audio process here at the KMXT station. Give us an email at kpla.alaska@gmail.com, or you can contact me, Lori Madsen, at 942-5552. We're always looking for new voices to add interest to our Dog-Eared Reads radio show. Well, that does it. You've spent the last hour listening to information about the Kodiak Public Library and the Kodiak Public Library Association. Hope you've enjoyed it, and hope to see you at the library or at our book sale.
Heaven in your breath, simplest of pleasures, the world at its best.